Recording it. Okay, go ahead. Dr. Naftali Yonatan is a lecturer in UCL in the Hebrew Studies Department in Jewish History and Spirituality, and the director of CRU, which is the Chabad Research Unit. And to find out more about what that is, you could ask Tali afterwards. But for now, talking about the menorah in Kabbalah, as you'll see in the pages. What's the menorah?
Okay, thank you very much. It's a very, very great pleasure to come back to Bristol. I was here three times, I think, quite a number of years ago, and it's really great meeting. A number of old friends, either my friend or my wife's friend. And so that's very special to be with you. So we're going to try to explore the menorah in Kabbalah. Okay, so we have at the beginning of this handout, at the beginning of this we have obviously a diagram of the menorah, a picture of the menorah. Does anyone recognize where it's from?
The Rambam.
Ah, cheat.
Oh, well, you asked.
Without using Hebrew knowledge. Right. It really was an error not translating what it says over here. Tzilum tzil ha-menorah shebeguf ktav yad kodesh ha-Rambam. Now, in the Bodleian Library, in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, there is a manuscript of Maimonides' commentary on the Mishnah. And this manuscript is actually in Maimonides' own hand. And what is very interesting about it is that it has a number of drawings which we assume are either by Maimonides himself or certainly approved by him, because the rest of the manuscript is in his own handwriting. One of the drawings is a drawing of the temple. So it's a rather interesting drawing, putting together the measurements of the temple as described in the Mishnah in Tractate Nidot. And there are a few other drawings, and one of them is of the menorah, and this is his drawing of the menorah. It looks like a woodcut style of presentation, where there was a triangular piece of wood stuck into ink and then pushed onto the paper, and another one which was a circular piece of wood, and that seems to be how it's been done, but I do not know whether the actual page shows any marks of an impression or something like that. And then very carefully drawn straight lines, and this almost geometrically drawn concave structure at the bottom, which is the base of the menorah. Now, this is drawn in connection also with Tractate Midot, I think. One second. Do you know, I'm actually at this moment I have forgotten. See, as you get older, you forget details. And so it's one that I've...
We want our money back, no?
No, it's in Hilchot Beit HaBchira. It's in the law. No. No, if it's in Parashat Mishnah. Sorry. Because Tractate Midot mentions the menorah. So maybe it is in Midot. Maybe it is in Midot. It mentions the menorah there. I'm just intrigued. You see, in Mishneh Torah of Maimonides, there is a long description of the menorah, and it would fit that this should be here, it should be there. But I associate this picture with the Perush on the Mishnah. Do you remember anything else? No, you're not sure. I think it's in volume 21 of the Kutei Sichas, but it may not tell the source of the Rambam. Now, the point, the interesting thing about this is that it helps us, you see, the thing is, in the book of Exodus, where it describes the menorah in the temple, now this is the menorah in the temple, this is the seven-branch menorah, this is not a diagram of the Chanukah menorah. But there is, let me try to explain what is significant about this, in Kabbalistic terms. Because in the description in the book of Exodus, in Parshat Truma, where it describes the different objects which were in the sanctuary, in the prototype of the temple, it speaks about a gviyah, it calls it, a goblet. And the question is, what does it mean by a goblet? And the goblet is a decoration on the branches of the menorah. Now, is this goblet upwards or is it downwards? Now, if you look at this image and you imagine, which seems to be the case, that the triangular images are the the triangular images are the goblet. Which way is the goblet pointing? Is the goblet upwards or down?
Downwards.
Now that is a fascinating idea, because that is what opens the Kabbalistic way of understanding the menorah as representing the seven sefirot, the seven branches of the menorah in the temple, as representing channels of radiance which are flowing downwards. So the menorah is an expression of light which is coming down into the world. And there are a number of places in biblical texts where we have lists of attributes which relate to the central theme of the Zoharic Kabbalah, which is the theme of the Sfirot, the divine emanations, and the menorah, which is described in the book of Exodus talking about the sanctuary, the book of Kings talking about the temple, and the book of Zechariah, which also has a beautiful dream image of the, or visionary image of the menorah. We read this as the Haftorah on the Shabbat of Hanukkah. Ra'iti menorah zahav. I saw a menorah of gold. And he describes a fascinating system of a golden cistern for oil. And from this golden globe, which held oil, and the oil goes through seven channels to the lights of the menorah in order to feed them with oil. And above the golden globe, there is a, that's called a gula, gula al-rosha, so that it's a globe filled, a bowl filled with oil, and above it there are two olive trees mysteriously pouring oil into the bowl. So this is Zechariah. If you like graphic images, Zechariah is one of the biblical books to read, because there are all kinds of interesting images there in the book of Zechariah. And so that idea that the menorah is a flow, it's a flow coming down from God into the world. Now, that brings us to our next diagram, which is the Sfirot. Now, I'm sorry that yours is a black and white diagram, but it's taken from this one. I wasn't able in the time to get you color copies, but it's a black and white diagram. Now, perhaps I should at this point try to explain that my goal this evening, in the time that we have together, is to try to discuss the Chanukah menorah relating to Chanukah in general, but I'm trying to discuss it in three ways. One way is as an expression of the relationship of the divine with the world. The second way is relating to the individual's own relationship with the divine, and perhaps the relationship of one individual with another, which is part of our relationship with the divine. And thirdly, the concept of the transformation of existence, the idea of transforming the darkness of existence into light. So in other words, there is the relationship with the divine, there is the divine and the world, A, there is the individual and other individuals and with God, and there is the global perspective. Okay, so those are three dimensions that we're going to try and tackle, 5 minutes each, and then we get to the luck. Okay, so just looking at these spherot, you see above there is the infinite, the beyond, the totally transcendent infinite called Ein Sof by the Kabbalists, without end, literally infinite. And that is the ultimate realm from, that is the God, the source of all being, and beyond the source of all being as well. As it says in a Kabbalistic text, it is not the main thing about God that he creates the universe. God is infinitely beyond the fact that he creates the universe. But he also does create the universe. So God is infinite. And so then comes divine will, which is often called Keter, the crown. And then we have wisdom, understanding and knowledge, Chochmah, Binah and Da'at, which can be understood as inspiration, contemplation, and commitment when translated into psychological qualities. Because one of the features of the Hasidic commentary on the Kabbalah, which is the one that I'm seeking to explain, encapsulate to you today, this evening, is the translation of mystical concepts into psychological terms. So what might just be called wisdom in the Kabbalistic text is described as inspiration in the Hasidic text. So it takes it and internalizes it into the life of the person. So there is inspiration, then understanding, bina, lehit bonen. So Chochmah is something which is Koach Ma, the power of that which is beyond, like Koach, potential. And Ma is as if what? It's like something, it's beyond, you don't know what it is, it's like a lightning flash. Then comes Bina, understanding, Lihit Bonen, to think about, to contemplate, to explore, that from the lightning flash, there come all kinds of ways of exploring this idea in multiple versions. And then comes Da'at, knowledge. And Da'at is like Vaha'adam Yavda et Chava. Adam knew Eve. He bonded with Eve. There was this commitment, this idea that the knowledge is not just abstract knowledge, but it's knowledge that concerns you, and therefore you're going to do something about it. And so therefore, that then flows into the seven sfirot, which are the sfirot which we see as being represented in the menorah, that number seven, and also the 7 days of the week. Kindness, chesed, giving, severity, gvura, withholding, mercy, which is a kind of combination of both of them. Kindness by itself would represent just unlimited giving without any kind of thought as to whether it's appropriate to give. Severity, withholding, is the opposite. Mercy, often called tiferet or splendor, is the combination of the two in the right balance, the right mizuch. Then comes, in the process of giving, the quality of netzach, victory over adversity, and submission, which is hod. This structure of sfirot is described by Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Lviv, who was a Kabbalist and Hasidic teacher in the end of the 18th century, the founder of the Chabad school. And in the book called Tanya, which has a number of letters by him as well, there is a letter which describes the Sfirot as a process of communication. Now this is very interesting as a paradigm of what the spiritual process of existence is. It is a divine communication. It is a self-communication by the divine, and we are somehow part of that process. But the image that Rabbi Shneur Zalman uses is explaining the Sfirot in terms of a teacher communicating with a pupil. And so there is the wish, kindness is the wish to give, is the wish to communicate, but if a great mathematician wants to communicate to his first year class in university or year seven class in school, he can't start off with the most difficult concepts. On the other hand, in order to think what to teach the class, you maybe need a truly great mathematician to be able to find ideas which will teach those pupils in such a way that they will love mathematics. And so therefore he has to choose carefully what he is going to teach. So therefore there is a whole structure of deciding which way he or she should be teaching. And part of that is victory over the problem that the pupil won't understand. And then the teacher has to say to herself, no, there is a way which I can communicate this idea. And that sometimes means submission, listening to the pupil and hearing what the pupil has to say in order to find the right mode of communication. And then, says Rabbi Shneur Zalman, in any teaching process, now he's writing this, it's probably 1805, 1810, then he's writing this letter. He says, in any teaching process, you could have exactly the same words being said by the teacher. But if the teacher says it with love and concern and dedication and focus on the pupil, then the words go in. And if he says it just in a dry way without being interested in the pupil at all, then it doesn't go in at all and it doesn't have the same effect, which is exactly what any teaching manual today will when teaching inspectors come, whether they're looking at university classes or school classes, they're concerned about the interaction with the pupils. And so that focus, and in fact, as a famous sociologist, Peter Berger, put it, that if you are trying to teach someone something very subtle, like how to play a violin, it's not enough just to give the technique. There has to be love in the process, and it's through the love that there is between the teacher and the pupil, and the pupil and the teacher, that the pupil is able to become a star violin player because he's wonderful. I remember once having a friend at that point, he was trying to become a concert pianist. He ended up becoming an academic in the field of music in Berkeley. And he had this little Hungarian lady teacher in London, and he loved this teacher, and she was able to teach him music in this way. So that's the quality of dedication, that's yisod, that's the that's sixth sfera, and then finally comes kingship, fulfillment, like the Shabbat, in the 6 days of the week, and the seventh is Shabbat. That is the absolute fulfillment. Now, these Sfirot, given that there is this idea that the menorah represents a flow of light down into the world, and we can see the menorah as an expression of the radiance of these Sfirot, that is the first step, and that is one category of looking at the menorah as an expression of the divine relationship with the world, a flow of light which is flowing into the world. Now, the very word light in relation to God is a very interesting concept. We do not find this in the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, in the Chumash. It doesn't talk about God as light. But in the book of Daniel, there is actually a phrase, one second, which I can note it down, if I can find my note. Unohore imei shrei. Unohora imei shrei. It's in Aramaic. It's in Daniel chapter 2, verse 22. Radiance is with him. It's speaking the Or Shochenito. That would be the Hebrew translation. Radiance dwells with God. Now, in our prayers, in the Jewish liturgy, God as radiance, the radiance of God. One second. In the Birchat Kohanim, you have the idea of radiance. Ya'er. I just thought of that. And that would be in the five books of Moses, because the Birchat Kohanim is in the book of Numbers, and so you have there radiance. Ya'er Hashem. That's right. May Hashem shine His face to you. That so there you actually do have the concept of radiance in the five books of Moses. I think it's the only place where you get that concept. But that then comes into our liturgy. Ki ba'ochenu Avinu kulanu ka'echad, bless us, Father, all of us as one, bo'or panecha, in the radiance of your countenance. Ki bo'or panecha, because with the radiance of your countenance, natata lanu Hashem lekeinu Torah chayim ba'avat chesed. You have given us, O Lord our God, the Torah of life and the love of love of kindness. This idea, the radiance of your countenance, which we do have in the priestly prayer. So it is there in the Torah, and it's also there in the liturgy, and it's there in the book of Daniel. This sense of divine radiance. Now, for the Kabbalists, once there is the image of radiance, one is able to speak about the divine as a source of radiance, and there is the Ein Sof, the infinite beyond radiance. And then you have the Or Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite. And then one can speak about another stage in the existence of the world, making room for the world, for the universe, by the Tzimtzum, by the veiling of the radiance, and then the world being created within that realm of where God is in some sense veiled, but there is room to create the world. So the image of radiance with the menorah, with the lights, the shining light of the menorah, and the upside down goblets, which are, as it were, pouring this radiance through the central stem. We could imagine this central stem as where the other six branches of the menorah in the temple are pouring into the world, and there is the base of the menorah, and from the base of the menorah, as it were, it is flowing into the world. So that aspect of the menorah as representing this primal image of the infinite pouring light and blessing into the world. Now, of course, there are other images in the Torah about this kind of process. For example, the dream of the ladder. That was in the Torah reading last week, that Jacob dreams of the ladder, And on the ladder there are angels going up the ladder and angels coming down to the ladder. And the Zohar comments, Sulam, ladder, Dat Slota, that means prayer. And the words of the prayer and the feelings of the prayer are the angels going up the ladder, and the blessing from God are the angels coming down the ladder. So the idea of a kind of a process in which there's something reaching up to God and something flowing down from God into the world is there in the ladder image. In the menorah, we don't exactly... what we have is the image of the flow downward. How do we achieve that flow? We have to light the menorah. So it's lighting the menorah, this process of illumination where the person comes and somehow or other lights the candles of the menorah or lights the wick of the menorah. That is the step in which there's the interaction between the person or the Jewish people and the divine as imaged in the menorah. Okay, so that is a brief look at the menorah as a concept of the divine relationship with the world. Now let's go to the menorah as depicting our own individual quality as people and as people relating with each other. Now we start with an idea which takes off directly from what we've just been saying about the different lights of the menorah representing the different sfirot, with the idea that the menorah represents the entire Jewish people. Now, this is found also in Rabbi Shneur Zalman's writings in the Likutei Torah, and he talks there about the, or in Torah, or, and he talks there about the way that the different members of the Jewish people express the different qualities of the different sfirot. One person might be very much the mode of chesed, of kindness, of giving. Another one might be the mode of severity, of withholding. Another one is very much into being victorious and always winning. And another one is more subtle and submits, but they may still win. There's a way of winning by, as in judo or something. You know, you fall, and that's the way you get your opponent to sail over your head into the shrubbery. So that's
it's called a feint.
Wonderful. Yes. With both spelling. Yes. Both spelling. Right. So there are. And so Rabbi Shneur Zalman says the seven sfirot represents seven different personality types, if you like, and each person is really made up of a mixture of these different elements. But if you remember, the menorah which was there in the sanctuary was made of one block of gold, and in fact it was so difficult to construct the seven branch menorah out of one block of gold that first of all, one Midrash says that God showed a fiery image of the menorah to Moses so that he should know how to make it. And then when Bezalel actually came to make it, he threw up his hands in exasperation. He couldn't make the menorah, so he just took the block of gold, threw it in the fire, and out came the menorah. So the menorah really is a mysterious combination of opposites, in a sense, because there you have these different warring characters of the different, like kindness and severity, and they're all sitting in the menorah, and they're all part of that one quality, so of that one block of gold. So that idea of everyone being representing, in some sense representing, a light, an illumination in the menorah, and however difficult that other person is, one is able to think to yourself, look, I'm this kind of illumination, and he is that kind of illumination, and we are part of the same one menorah. Now, the thrust, you see, the Kabbalists in Tzfat, in Safed, in the 16th century, and indeed earlier Kabbalists as well, such as those who lived in Gerona in the 13th century, they formed little mystic circles where there was a small group of people and they had a teacher like Rabbi Isaac Luria or other figures, Moshe Kondovero, and there was this close togetherness among them. What was a very important transition in the whole process of the relationship of the Jewish community to these spiritual teachings was when they were taken beyond the mystic circle and they were somehow made the property of the Jewish people as a whole, partly through a process of publishing of books. So when the Shloh, Shnei Luchot HaBrit by Yeshaya HaLevi Horovitz was published in the 17th century, this was something which suddenly was making mystical teachings available to everyone, and there was a sense in which the whole Jewish people were being invited to spiritualize their lives in the style of Tzfat Kabbalism, which in fact many communities did adopt. For example, the idea of singing Zemirot at the Shabbat table, singing songs at the Shabbat table, comes from Tzfat. And there are a number of songs which were composed in Tzfat or at that time of the Tzfat society. So Rabbi Yisrael Najara was a fascinating poet who wrote a book which has been published called Zmirot Yisrael. It's a 16th century book. And he took songs, he created Hebrew songs, and he partly invented melodies for them, and partly he used melodies which were around at the time, which had been identified as Spanish or Turkish melodies, and he wrote which melody it was, just so that you understood which song to sing it to. And there was a lot of discussion about this whole process, which seemed to be incorporating songs from other cultures into Judaism, and yet somehow he transformed those melodies. And so there is a kind of process whereby something which is over the border is somehow brought into Jewish culture, and this is a very interesting concept, because Hanukkah, the Hanukkah lamp, the menorah, is on the border. But that's the third topic. So first of all, we dealt with topic one, we're now dealing with topic two, so we're going to approach topic three later. But first of all, let's just talk about topic two. Okay, so we're trying to get it in order. Now, one aspect is dealing with different people and feeling a sense of unity together. But another aspect is the menorah as an image of the service of the individual. Now, you do have a black and white photocopy of this picture here. This is the Zohar. Now, sorry? Okay, by all means.
Can I go home?
Okay, fair enough. Now, this is an image of the lamp, which is there in the Zohar. It gives the page reference in the Zohar over here. And it's quoted in Rabbi Shneur Zalman's Tanya, and it gives his reference as well. We have the idea that the wick is the person. So it's an oil lamp. So this is one of the lamps of the menorah, one of the seven or eight lamps of the menorah. So there is the wick which represents the person. Did that come out on the on the photocopy? No, it didn't come out. Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't. I omitted. Oh dear. I didn't realize that the wick didn't come out. So if everyone could draw the wick. Yes, that's right. That needs. That's a very important thing, to draw the wick. I'm so sorry it didn't come out. You never know what's going to photocopy and what's not. Or I don't know. So the wick is the actual person. The flame is the presence of the divine that hovers over the person's head, like an aura. So one can imagine that that is a way of seeing a person, that the person has this spiritual aura over their head. How do we get this aura to be there over our head. It's through the oil which flows through the wick and then burns and is, and we are able to have the aura around us. The way the Zohar presents it is that the oil are the mitzvot. The uvdin tavon, as it puts it in Aramaic, the good deeds of the person. The good deeds function as the oil which flows through the wick and enables this presence of the divine to shine around the person as an aura. As an aura, it's a beautiful image with the sense of responsibility that a person has. You know, it's as if, first of all, looking at another person and sort of seeing them as a kind of this aura around them. But also feeling a sense of responsibility that if one does the wrong thing, in some way one is reducing this aura that is there. So it's the idea of some positive spiritual quality which is there through the fact of the positive actions that the person is doing. And so that connection of the mitzvot and the aura of the presence of the divine. Now, this is the way it's described in the Zohar, and that's quoted word verbatim. In the Tanya, it just takes a page of Zohar and it puts that down on the page. However, the second image is what was written by the son of Rabbi Shneur Zalman. His name was Rabbi Dov Ber Shneuri, so Shneuri means like son of Shneur. And he wrote a book called Gates of Radiance. Now you mentioned what the Maharal wrote about Hanukkah. It could be that that book is also called Gates of Radiance, and it's about Hanukkah and Purim. And this book, Gates of Radiance, is also about Hanukkah and Purim. So I think that the Maharal wrote a book about Hanukkah and Purim. And then later on, Rabbi Dov Ber was actually his great-great-great-grandson. He wrote a book about Hanukkah and Purim. I'm not quite sure what the name of the Maharal's book was.
What's in the mitzvah light or something like that?
Oh, Ne Mitzvah V'Torah O.
I think it's called that.
Ne Mitzvah V'Torah O. It could well be.
Yes.
That could well be.
He talks about the significance of the flame.
Yeah.
The difference between a flame and a torch, something like that. Yeah.
Right. Now, certainly, the Maharal of Prague did write about. I think that some of these teachings go back to him. In Rabbi Dov Ber's book, The Gates of Radiance, Sha'arei Orah, we have this development of the Zohar's image. Now, I suppose the wick hasn't come out in this picture either.
You've drawn it in.
No. You've drawn it in.
We've imagined it.
Now we've
good,
yeah, good drawing.
We've done a good projection.
Okay, right. Now he...
For how much you should cover it.
Well, the step that he's taken is talking about two different aspects of the flame. You see, there's the wick, which is the person, and the oil are the mitzvot, the good deeds. Right. But then comes the kind of flame, and he is now talking about a flame that we somehow project ourselves. It's not just that there's a divine aura nestling around the person. The aura is somehow a product of our own relationship with the divine. So the dark flame, which is near the wick, is the aspect of self-control. This is the part of the flame which burns the wick. The wick has to be changed every so often, and it's because this dark flame is there consuming the wick. Now, I'm not sure how this actually is if you look at it in terms of chemistry and combustion, the chemistry of combustion. But the way it is in Sha'arei Orah and Gates of Light is that the dark, yes, any comments? The physics of combustion, I'm sorry. So there you have the dark flame, which is the self-control of the person. I don't know what it's like in Bristol, But in London there are frequent opportunities for people to exercise extremely great self-control when confronting parking meter attendants. Oh, you have the same, right, okay. What's called Makat Medina, a plague of the whole country. But this can be extremely aggravating when you know it was only 3 minutes, etc. And the amount of self-control which is required in certain such circumstances is very great, and the consolation is that at least it's producing this dark flame around the wick. And there is another dimension of the flame, is the bright flame of Ahavat Hashem, love of the divine, a moment of inspiration. There are times of inspiration. Let's imagine candles are being lit on Shabbat, on Friday afternoon before sunset, and one is lighting, the woman is lighting candles. It's a beautiful moment. The husband sees his wife lighting a candle. At that moment, there's something very, very beautiful which is taking place. Or one might be praying. It might be a moment of prayer. Sometimes in a special place, one might be at the west wall of the temple in Jerusalem. It might be Yom Kippur. Or it might be an ordinary Wednesday. An ordinary day of the week. And the moment of prayer, of saying the Shema, Va'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, you should love the Lord your God. That is a moment where the bright flame of love of the divine is able to be expressed. Now, if we imagine these different dimensions of love and of communication with God, which are there in each of these lamps, and that each of these lamps are part of the totality of the menorah, which is the entire Jewish people, so we have Ahavat Hashem, the love of the divine, and Ahavat Israel, and the love of one's fellow, and there we are unified together. And so that is the second dimension. So the first dimension was the menorah as the sefirot, revelation of God. The second dimension is the menorah as representing our own inner service. And now we come to the third dimension. Now for the third dimension, we have a page which says making the darkness shine. Okay, so this isn't a graphic page, it's just a text.
Maybe briefly add, I think, interestingly enough, the inner part of the flame, which you associate with control, is actually cooler than the outer part.
Dark flame is hotter, John. Red the bright. Orange flame is cooler.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know. I know white is hotter than orange.
Yeah, I think the inner part is cooler. Yeah.
But it would make a sense that it would be hotter towards the outside because all the smaller fractions of
I'm pretty sure the inner part is cooler, yeah.
Burn, so that's right.
Like in a Bunsen burner, the inner part is cool.
Ah, you're getting on my wick. It's a joke, John.
It's a joke. It's a joke, I see. All right. Well, I shan't attack.
You just reminded me of something that I missed. Sorry, so before we go on to part three, let me just stop at part two. That's very good, John, because that really was something that I'd forgotten. The idea that the vessel is acceptance. Now that is the core. Everyone would agree that the vessel is cold. The vessel is cold. And it's the vessel which holds the whole thing together. Because if you don't have the vessel, then you just have a splash of oil and bits of wick and so on splashed over the carpet. So you have to have a vessel. The vessel is described by Rabbi Dov Ber as the acceptance whereby the Kabbalat Ol, the fact that the person accepts that they're going to do something, or they're going to not do something, but they accept it even if it doesn't trigger off a gush of love and inspiration. It's just they say, you know what, let's do it. You know, let's do something this year that's Rabbi Lou, who was here a couple of weeks ago, so he was once, so we're close friends and we share a lot of stories together. So he was once in a taxi with a taxi driver, and he ascertained that the taxi driver was Jewish. Or, you know, he wasn't quite sure. He said, "Are you Jewish?" He said, "Yes, I'm Jewish." He said, "Do you ever go to shul?" He said, "Yes." And then there was a pause of a few seconds. "Mind you, sometimes I miss a year." You know, so a person could say, "Let's do Yom Kippur. You know, we, you know, maybe we didn't do it, but we'll do it this year." Now, that decision, that sense, or it might be, "Let's do Tefillin," or "Let's do Mikvah," or let's do something. Now, that step of acceptance, that's the vessel which holds the whole light together. So it's the power of being able to make a step of acceptance, which, you know, might be very private, or it might be something which involves more people around one or the family. That step of acceptance is the vessel holding the light. So that your cold flame reminds me of that, because that is a very crucial aspect of Judaism, to be able to act even when everything is cold. See, when things are very negative, then we might have a churning of an intense reaction, how to deal with this negative situation. I once heard a talk by a gentleman whose mother had been in Holland during the war. And she had been in hiding, and she had hidden her children, and all the kinds of deprivations that we have in the story of Anne Frank and things like that. But thank God, this mother, she survived and her children survived. However, after the war, she was extremely depressed. During the war, she'd functioned. She'd looked after the children and had been taking care of them, but under very, very difficult circumstances. But now, she was terribly depressed after the war. And just basically sitting, not exactly catatonic, but sitting in a chair doing nothing. And they went to a therapist. And the therapist said, "Well, look, maybe it's just being here in Amsterdam with all the terrible memories. Maybe take her on holiday somewhere." Okay, fine. So they're going to take her on holiday, and they got her on a boat, and they're going on a cruise. And they're going to visit Palestine, the land of Israel. And that will be a holiday, a respite for her. And she's just sitting on the boat, you know, sitting on this deck chair on the deck, and not doing anything, very miserable, very gloomy. And they're just coming into Haifa Harbor. And suddenly, the War of Independence has just begun. She immediately wakes up, gets up, she's now active, "Do this, you do that." She's, once there's adversity, she's able to function perfectly. It's only when nothing is happening that she's not able to do anything. So that image that there is, that when there's adversity, we generate the radiance in order to deal with that situation. But it's when everything is just very ordinary and normal, and that's when the flame is cold. That's when, and there's the cold vessel, the power of acceptance. Okay, so that does conclude part two, and we now come to part three, which is making the darkness shine. Now, in order to look at this, we're looking a little bit at the whole story of the Hanukkah menorah as a practice, which of course represents a battle. It represents a victory in a battle against the Greeks, and there's a whole lot of imagery here which I've had to miss out about Greek wisdom, the oil of wisdom, but let's just try to keep this simple in these three little categories. The Hanukkah menorah is lit at the time of twilight or darkness, which of course is quite different from the Shabbat candles, which are lit while it's still day, Friday afternoon before sunset. And the Shabbat candles are lit in the home. The whole idea of the Shabbat candles is that you're coming into the home, and there is the beautiful Shabbat atmosphere in the home. It's that warm, comfortable feeling inside. Whereas the Hanukkah menorah is actually lit in such a way that it shines towards the outside. The Talmud in Tractate Shabbat, around page 21, where it is talking about the way we light the Hanukkah menorah, it's in that same chapter, the second chapter of Shabbat, Bameh Madlikim, which we read, many communities read on Friday night, talking about the lighting of the Shabbat candles. So in that context, the Talmud takes the time to speak about the Hanukkah menorah, which is another version of lighting candles. So we so it explains there that in Talmudic times they would light the menorah on the at the in the doorway, and they would do it on the left side of the doorway. Now here we have the mezuzah over here, so it's like going into the garden. So the menorah would be put presumably over here. Is that how you would do it, if you were doing it this side? So you would put the menorah over here on the left side, the opposite side to the mezuzah. Now, this is constructed like that because the garden is a closed garden. And so it's as if we are outside the room, the garden is the room, and we're going into that room. But the point about the menorah, if we imagine it at the front door of the house, the mezuzah is one side going into the house, and the menorah is the other side shining out of the house. Now, it became the practice in the Middle Ages, instead of putting the menorah outside the doorway, outside, to put the menorah in the window. But it's still shining outside. In Israel, there is still the custom of putting the menorah at the doorway. And they develop beautiful, it's like a glass bell, which the menorah fits into so that it doesn't get blown out by the wind. So very charming menorahs in glass bells in Jerusalem doorways, I seem to remember. Now, so that idea of, and so of course the Talmudic reason for doing this is Pisumei Nisa, publicizing the miracle. But the idea of shining towards the outside is a very interesting concept, which we're going to look at in more Kabbalistic terms in a moment. The Talmud says the menorah is to be lit al dekal yorid de Talmudoi, till the feet of the Talmudians have ceased. Now, the Talmudians are a kind of gypsy people of Talmudic times, tinkers, who would come around selling kindling and other things for making the fires, and they were a nation, so like a kind of tinker society. Now, let's try and see how this is interpreted. What does this mean? The very word Talmud can be read as the word Moredet. It's got the same letters as the word rebel, suggesting in this context, Judaism is very often on the side of the rebel. we are the revolutionaries who left Egypt, and there are all kinds of ways in which Judaism has a sort of a revolutionary dimension to it. As someone was commenting on the problem of bourgeois concepts of life in the study of Jewish history, there's the concept of the balabos, the householder, and the pietist. So the pietist and the householder. The householder is the typical bourgeois concept, living in the city and with city values. And then comes the pietist, who is somehow or other stirring up some kind of other paradigm. And so But in this context, rebel is something negative. Okay, so rebel is often a positive idea. But here it's something negative. Kalia suggests ceasing, kilion. So in other words, what the light which shines towards the outside is doing, somehow or other, this sort of spiritual radiance, which really reaches to a very exalted height of the Ein Sof, it's shining into the outside with the idea of somehow pushing away that negativity, reducing that negativity. But the word kalya not only means kilyon, which means ceasing, it also suggests the word kalot ha-nefesh, which is being inspired. Kalot ha-nefesh means the yearning of the soul. As King David says in Psalms, the he uses the phrase of the kilyon, the yearning, the expiry of the soul as an expression of intense feeling. So the goal is that the radiance, when we look at it in this sort of global level, the radiance of the Hanukkah menorah, which means this deep connection with the divine, which is beyond being defiled. The Hanukkah story is about a mass defection from Judaism in the time of the Syrian Greeks. The Alexander the Great conquered the land of Israel and many other countries, and then when he passed away, his kingdom was divided up among his generals, and eventually the land of Israel fell to the portion of the Seleucid kings who ruled from Antioch in Syria. And the Jewish ruling classes began to adopt Greek-style of behavior. It was the process of Hellenization in the Jewish community. And idolatry in the Greek manner and other aspects of Greek life became part and parcel of what Jews were doing. And it seemed as if Judaism was going to disappear, not only because of the process of the Jews themselves adopting Hellenism, but then Antiochus Epiphanes, a very remarkable, cruel king in this dynasty, deciding that he's going to enforce Hellenism among the Jews. And then circumcision was forbidden, and other aspects of Jewish life were forbidden. The study of Torah was forbidden. So there we have the attempt to extinguish Jewish singularity. And yet, there is the fact that the Maccabees were able to arouse the whole people somehow to fight against this process, to re-establish Judaism, and there was the miracle of the Hanukkah lamp, the menorah in the temple being lit and lasting for 8 days in a miraculous way. Now, that is plumbing the level of the Jew, who is a Jew whatever happens, whatever might be, whatever the external situation. The Jew is an extremely interesting kind of individual because he or she could go through a process of almost total assimilation and yet have a very deep bond, bonding him or her to the divine in a Jewish mode, which is really something very dramatic and
powerful.
Very powerful, yes. It is indeed. And that power is not only something which is there within the person connecting him or her to the divine, it's something which is able to affect a transformation of the surrounding what is very often a darkness. And so the concept here in this chain of teachings is not just that a little bit of light pushes away much darkness. In other words, the power of the menorah is that the illumination shines into the dark, and so it's not so dark. The darkness has been pushed away. It's something much more global. It is a recognition that ultimately, in the whole of existence, there is goodness. And that ha-choshech atzmo yair, the darkness itself should shine. That the ultimate goodness, which is there, hidden in existence, should be revealed. And this really expresses the ultimate goals of Jewish teaching. The darkness of existence, the negativity, is not just pushed away. It's transformed to light. And this is really our goal as Jews in the world. That there are dimensions of darkness, many different kinds of darkness. And we come with a moral teaching from the Torah, and a spiritual perception, which is emphasized in Kabbalistic and Hasidic thought. And the goal is that the darkness which is around us should not only be held at bay, more should happen. The darkness itself should be transformed into something positive, and that power, which is that every human being, a person does not have to be a Jew in order to have the world to come. As Maimonides says, every single human being, if they keep the seven Noahide laws, they live life as a moral person and understand the relationship with God, which is there, they are at least a sage, and if they appreciate that this is something through the revelation of the Torah on Mount Sinai, it makes them not only a sage, but it makes them a chassid umot ha'olam, a righteous Gentile. And this quality is something which the menorah, in fact, expresses, something which is the universal dimension of Judaism. So therefore, looking at these Kabbalistic teachings, which on one level are like, they are the mystic circle aspect of Judaism. You know, there's the Judaism of the synagogue and the Judaism of the home, and then there's the mystic circle, there's the rarefied atmosphere of Safed in Israel. And then we actually find that as we take this through the process of Hasidic interpretations of this Kabbalistic mixture, especially Chabad Hasidic, with its deconstructed power, to take the border which is there around the warmth of the home and somehow open those walls so that that warmth and that illumination is also expressed in the world around us. So that's the goal of the coming of Messiah. Right. Okay, John, I can see John for the
question. Yes, you've touched on so many interesting things. As you may have noticed in your line of work, numbers are often quite significant in Judaism, particularly in mysticism. I'm very interested, it just suddenly occurred to me whilst we were talking actually, that the menorah in the temple has got seven branches. The Hanukkah menorah, if you ignore the Shabbos, right, which you just use after all the lighting, has got eight.
Right.
According to my calculations, eight is seven plus one. Seven has got a great central mystical significance because of the seventh day is Shabbat when the world was created. I know that the Hanukkah lights lasted for 8 days, but beyond that, because there's no one reason for anything in Judaism as far as I can work out, is there some significance to that? I mean, for instance, is the menorah in some way connected to the function of the Shabbos candles, in the Galut? And if so, is the Hanukkah menorah like the Shabbos candles plus an extra dimension?
It's a very, very, very important point. Let's just focus on the Kabbalistic image for the moment. The image of seven is like the cycle of what is within the frame of the downchaining of the worlds. Because that is expressed with the number seven, the 6 days of the week, then Shabbat. So that's the cycle of seven. Whereas eight is something which reaches beyond that cycle. So it reaches the essence. And it's that ability, that power of reaching the essence, which then has got the power to transform the darkness. Because from the point of view of the essence, light and dark are the same. From the point of view of within the cycle of six and seven, there's a great difference between the weekday and Shabbat, so that is a realm of differences. Whereas beyond those differences is reaching to the essence where darkness can be transformed into light, precisely because one is reaching beyond the distinction. So that is a very important concept. That's 7-2. Thank you.
What about Shmona and Shemen?
Mm-hmm. Shmona and Shemen. All right, that's interesting. The word Shemen is oil, and Shmona is eight. Although I've never exactly heard any. It's an interesting idea, but and it may be. I think actually the 25th. Since we're speaking about numbers, the 25th word in the Torah is Or, light. And Hanukkah is on the 25th day of Kislev. So,
thank you very much, Abba. Amazing. I can go.
Okay.
Shalom. Shalom. We have to go. We've got a previous appointment. No, we're going to Michael's house.
I'll get these back to you because I will work.
What's going on?
Thank you everyone for coming. If anyone has any more questions, then feel free to ask Dr. Lowenthal. I just wanted to mention, first of all, there are Hanukkah, everyone help yourself to food and drinks, and there's Hanukkah guides here on the table, so if anyone wants to take one, feel free. Just give you some insights about Hanukkah. On the 21st of December, the first night of Hanukkah, on Sunday the 21st of December at 5 o'clock, there's going to be a public menorah lighting, please God, right next to the Falafel King. So, one of the most famous landmarks in Bristol. And then on the 24th, Wednesday, there's going to be a Hanukkah party in the shul on 1 o'clock, starting at 1 o'clock.
After the Hanukkah...
And after the Hanukkah menorah lighting, there's a show event.
There's a Hanukkah quiz in the show.
With supper, something to eat.
Everybody is welcome. You're still welcome.